It's on. All right, we're good to go. Well, I'm going to begin with a couple of scientific discoveries, and then we'll give you a quick report on what happened in Trinidad, and then we'll jump into 1 Samuel, which is the introduction, really, to the creation psalm we're looking at, Psalm 139. What caught my attention was a paper in Ecology Letters that was titled Extraordinarily Widespread and Fantastically Complex. That was the title. The subtitle was Comparative Biology of Endosymbiotic Bacterial and Fungal Mutualists of Insects. You say, what does all that mean?
They don't get out.
They don't get out. That's the whole idea. So these are bacteria and fungi that are on the body or interior to the body of these insects. And this particular paper is pointing out that there's been considerable research on bacteria and insects, and that bacteria and insects are kind of like what bacteria do for us. They fill our digestive tract, and they assist our digestion, and it's a symbiosis. We feed the bacteria, and the bacteria help us digest our food. And so both benefit. That's what symbiosis is all about. Two different species that mutually assist one another. Yes, what kind of question? Or is somebody just cleaning his glasses? Okay. sorry about that. And then there are bacteria that propagate our skin. And you say, how do they help us? Well, we feed them, but they also protect us from a more pernicious attack. And so actually they've discovered that 21st century Americans are having problems because they're being overly clean. And by being overly clean, they're ridding their bodies of all of these beneficial symbiotic bacteria.
Is that through the antibacterial
soaps? Antibacterial soaps are really the problem. And so the advice now to Americans is wash with soap, but don't wash with antibacterial soap. Because by taking all the bacteria off your skin, you expose your skin to attacks that the bacteria would normally prevent that from happening. And so like modern day Americans are having problems with rashes that they never had before, and it's because they're too clean. So my sons are really grateful to hear about all this research. So, yes. No, this is now a consensus in the scientific community that we've not been paying attention to the fact that the bacteria that reside in our bodies actually help fulfill a helpful purpose, and that we would be unwise to kill them all. So, and there's this idea today that all bacteria are bad. No, you need bacteria in your stomach. In fact, I found out from my colleague, Fuzz Rana, that for the average human being, maybe not the average American, but for the average human being, there's actually more bacterial cells on and in your body than there are human cells. The bacteria actually outnumber the cells in your body, and that's a good thing. So, yes?
Is this the wrong time to ask about raw milk versus pasteurized milk?
Well, you're probably asking the wrong guy. I'm not an expert on that, but we do have biologists in the class who are probably better able to answer that question about pasteurization. Yes?
Calling somebody pond scum,
yes, actually has some element of truth. Anyway, we appreciate that insects benefit the same way. They have bacteria in their digestive tracts, which helps them digest their food. So they feed the bacteria, but the bacteria help feed them. And likewise, the bacteria on their bodies prevent them from getting serious attacks from much more deadly organisms. So what this article is pointing out is that what's been ignored is the role of fungi. And what this research study points out is that over 80% of insects have symbiotic fungi on and in their body. The problem is the science is so new, we're really not sure what the symbiosis is, but what this experiment's talking about is where they remove the fungi from the insects and the insects suffer deleterious effects. And when they return the fungi to the insects, they get healthy again. So clearly there's a symbiotic relationship going on between the fungi and the insects, and this basically it's two authors who are saying, this is worthy of research. We need to study this because we've been doing a lot of research on the bacteria. We've been ignoring the fungi. And this is something that is very widespread, as it says in the title of the paper, extraordinarily widespread and so fantastically complex, we really don't know what's going on. Although, as I went through the literature, I found another paper. By the way, I found 13 papers in the scientific literature published in the last 30 days that address the subject of insect-fungal symbiosis. But in all these papers, they're really kind of scratching their heads trying to figure what it is, except for one paper. I found a paper in the Journal of Industrial Microbiology and Biotechnology. Now, I got to confess, I didn't even know that journal existed. And, you know, maybe you know all about it, but I had no idea that the journal even existed. And so I went through the journal, and it really has some tremendous papers in it. But this one had the title, Insect Fungal Symbionts, a Promising Source of Detoxifying Enzymes. And what their research points out is that one thing the fungi are doing for the insects is detoxifying toxins that exist in the environment and can come up on the bodies of these insects. And basically what the paper is pointing out is that this is worthy of research because, after all, we human beings face toxins and we're struggling to find these detoxifying enzymes. And if we do research on these insect-fungi symbiotic relationships, it's going to have some medical benefits for us, which means when you have Thanksgiving, you can spend some time thanking God for all these insects that are out there. I'm not sure I'm going to get that across to my wife, that we really need to thank God for a whole set of species of bugs out there, and bugs in both senses of the terms. So, but the whole point is there's medical advances that can be gained from studying this symbiosis. As I went through these 13 papers, one thing became clear. Symbiotic relationships between insects and bacteria and insects and fungi is very widespread. And as it says in this first paper, it's extraordinarily complex. And it raises the whole issue, how can this be unless there's a creator? I mean, how would you anticipate evolution ever producing these symbiotic relationships, especially at this complex of a level? Because for symbiosis to work, you have to have the two species showing up at the same time and coming together somehow so they can mutually benefit one another. If they arise on the ecological scene at different times, the symbiosis isn't going to happen. And if the creature exists by itself, it's going to have a problem. And so you really need the two species existing at the same time and somehow coming into contact with one another, and where the mutualism can begin immediately. Now, that defies an evolutionary explanation. It would fit perfectly a creation explanation. You'd anticipate that a creator would want to have these symbiotic relationships where these different species could really benefit one another and cooperate with one another so that they can reach an end goal. And what's that end goal? What we saw in Psalm 104. How it's God's goal that our planet be packed with the maximum biomass and biodiversity for the maximum time. And for that to be feasible, you would need ubiquitous and complex symbiotic relationships. And one of the papers I picked up is an update. This has been around for some time, but it's an update published in the latest annual reviews of microbiology. So this issue came out just literally days ago. And the title is Plants, Mycorrhizal Fungi, and Bacteria, a Network of Interactions. So it's reviewing the past 20 years of research on these ants. And these are ants that harvest leaves off of a plant. They don't eat the leaves. What they do is they chew them up and spit them out. And they feed the spit out stuff to the fungi. And the fungi will feed on this spit out material from the ants, and then the ants eat the fungi. And this is what's called a four-way symbiotic relationship, because the fungi cannot feed on the plants unless the ants cut the leaves and then chew them up in their mouths, get all that kind of saliva in it, and basically make the leaves safe for the fungi to feed on. Because the plant produces a toxin, and by producing a toxin, it prevents too many leaves of being chewed up. But you know, here are these ants that are able to cut these leaves, chop up the little bits and pieces, process them in such a way that the fungi can feed on. So why don't the plants just eat the leaves? Well, they can't eat the leaves. The leaves will provide them no nutrition, and so what they do is they kind of process the leaves, feed them to the fungi. The fungi feed on this stuff that the ants provided for them, and then the ants eat the fungi. And it's a four-way mutualism, because actually the trees that produce the leaves also benefit in the sense that they really are being kept safe from other herbivores that would be feeding on the leaves because of the toxins. But it's such that if you don't have the ants harvesting these leaves, then the plant suffers in terms of its overall growth. And so it's a four-way mutualism. The tree benefits, the ant benefits, the fungi benefits. And oh yeah, I forgot the fourth one. There's bacteria that grow on the bodies of the fungi. And it's those fungi that actually work with the ant chewing it up to make the leaf that's been cut safe for the fungi. And so, you know, the ants take care of the bacteria on their bodies. The bacteria in their bodies help out with the processing of the cut leaf. And then the fungi benefits because it's being fed a food supply it otherwise could not get. And the ants are clever enough that they can actually have these farms. And so what's happening is you have these ants with all these farms out there of these fungi. And by the way, this isn't just one species. They have identified dozens of species that do this. And some of the species of ants, what they do is they will actually do the equivalent of animal husbandry. They will actually get these farms of aphids. So they care for the aphids, and the aphids do the processing. So it's, again, very complex, diverse, but you're seeing four- and five-way symbiotic mutualism going on. And again, this would be the hallmark of a creator. It's not something you would ever anticipate from an evolutionary perspective. Yeah, Al?
Yeah, doesn't some kind of fungus begin inside your body and actually kill you?
Oh yeah, there's bad bacteria, there's bad fungi, but there's good bacteria. And it's, I think the human species in the 21st century in a high-tech environment is the only species of animals that are fungi-free. So typically we are fungi-free. So at least with us, we don't have the symbiotic relationship going on with the fungi, but we definitely do with the bacteria. But every other animal species, they do have fungi living on and inside them. And if you're living in a third world country, there'll be fungi operating there too. Now, whether or not these fungi have any benefit, I don't know whether that's been established or not. Some have speculated that maybe third world people are getting cancer less frequently because of the fungi that they're dealing with, but there's been no proof of that, at least as far as I know. Yes?
Can some of these symbiotic relationships of bacteria and, let's say, insects, did those bacteria that are in the symbiotic relationship with insects, did God only create them at the same time as he did the insects?
Well, we know the end result. I mean, what's interesting is these authors are all trying to claim, isn't it amazing what evolution has pulled off to make something so incredibly complex and so incredibly mutualistic? But the question is, how would evolution ever make that happen, especially at this degree of complexity? And it's similar to the argument about repeated evolutionary outcomes, where you see species that are unrelated in any evolutionary paradigm having the identical design features. And what the evolutionists say, well, it was an accident. It was an accident of evolution. But when you've got hundreds of accidents, then you begin to say, well, that really can't be. You mean maybe it's a coincidence that it happens once. And that's basically how they're responding to all these examples of symbiosis. They're saying sheer accident. But what these papers are pointing out, how can you call it a sheer accident if it's that ubiquitous and that complex?
So we know in general bacteria occur before insects.
Yes.
But in the situation where you have bacteria that has a symbiotic relationship with, let's say, these insects, will those bacteria not create them?
Well, that would be the, you know, a reasonable conclusion to draw, is that, you know, these bacteria were created later. Or you could say that the bacteria went through, but the evolutionists claim as well, bacteria can exchange genes. Maybe they can have very rapid evolution. And so there's some speculation as to where the malaria bacteria came from. I mean, it attacks human beings and only human beings. But maybe it got to us through some, exotic evolutionary step from another species. I mean, it's interesting that it tells you in the Levitical law that we human beings are to avoid bestiality. Well, there's some good reasons why we're to avoid bestiality, because that can be a venue whereby viruses and bacteria can attack us that were never intended to attack us, because they do have the capability. They are the fastest evolvers on the planet. And so, you've got to be careful. So, yeah, there is some speculation exactly how this happens. But, it's one thing to get the bacteria, but when you look at particularly these mycorrhizal fungi, it's not just that you have the different species mutually supporting one another. There are structures that have got to be in place for the mutualism to take place. So, like 80% of plants have a symbiotic relationship with mycorrhizal fungi. And the plant actually provides a nodule on the root system, nodules on the root system to house the mycorrhizal fungi. And what those do is they will process certain minerals so that the plant can receive those. Well, somehow those minerals that are processed by the fungi have got to be channeled into the root system of the plant so the plant can actually use it. And the plant also has to have a channel system to provide sugars and starches for the fungi so they can survive. And so you need transportation systems in place as well as the species is in place. And it's all got to be at the right time and the right place for it to work. Now, that's something that would be easy for a creator to design. Trying to figure out how evolution can do all that by random accidents is the real challenge. Now, again, there are evolutionists who say, well, sheer accident, but as I reported about 6 weeks ago here in class, this mycorrhizal fungi symbiosis, which was thought to only apply to a few species, we now recognize as ubiquitous. And that's what this paper is pointing out, that we've known for some time that bacterial insect symbiotic relationships were ubiquitous, but now we're discovering the same thing's true of fungi, and we haven't found out what the symbiosis is yet. Well, yeah, I mean, for insects, there's millions of species. So we're talking lots of species. So, yes?
Yes, I remember reading that the number of pathogenic organisms for humans is something under 5% of the species that occupy the cell, and the vast majority of them are beneficial. And also for the digestive tract, there is an organism called Candida albicans, I believe is classified as a fungus. And it's normally beneficial, but it can have a hyphae form in which it invades other tissues, so it can be even one.
Right.
So it does perform a normal function as a fungus in the digestive tract.
Yep. A fungus among us. I think I heard that joke before. All right. But yeah, you might be interested in just some of the titles of these papers. As I mentioned, you got this network of interactions among plants, mycorrhizal fungi, and bacteria. There's one about insects that harvest fungi. Characterization of microbial communities colonizing the hypo surfaces of arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi. Fun papers y'all got to read. Plant growth promoting rhizobacteria. So. Yeah, yeah. And what's also what I found is new is that they're now studying these symbiotic relationships in the oceans. And so they're looking at the insect larvae in lakes and oceans and finding fungal symbiosis taking place there. So it's not just with the adults, it also happens with the larvae. And it's a different species with the larvae than with the adults. So, yeah. Insect symbioses, a case study of past, present, and future fungus growing ant research. And so these are where the ants kind of do what we do, where they actually get herds of aphids to help them out, or they actually plant pasture lands full of fungi. Yes?
Step-by-step process, how this might have evolved?
Well, there are papers where they try to take that on for the repeated evolutionary designs we see in the higher animals, like the reptiles, amphibians, and mammals and birds. And there the suggestion is that there's hidden laws of physics that we haven't discovered yet that would explain this self-organizing principle that we see manifested. In terms of symbiosis, I've not seen any literature trying to explain in any kind of detail from an evolutionary perspective how this would happen. Basically, they just make comments, isn't it amazing what evolution has done? But they don't tell you how evolution could have made it happen. Whereas in the case of the repeated design outcomes or evolutionary outcomes, at least there's an attempt to try to identify what would happen. But the bottom line is, whatever you have for a cause, you should be able to search and figure it out. I mean, that's the big critique about the evolutionary explanation for the repeated design outcomes, is if there's a hidden law of physics, it shouldn't be that hard to find that hidden law. And the truth is, when we look for that law, we don't find it. So, okay, moving on. Yes?
It's actually pretty hard to kill fungi, I think, isn't it? Because I had it on my toenail for years, and I've tried everything, including hydrochloric acid, and then nothing killed it. I think unless it's maybe a lack of oxygen, you know, where you...
Well, yeah, that's how you kill the more pernicious weeds that are out there, is you starve them. You know, where I grew up in British Columbia, the weed that was impossible to kill was blackberries. And you know, they would, I mean, I love blackberries, but they literally become a weed where they take over everything. Because in British Columbia, it's wet with acid soils, which blackberries love, and they literally choke out every other kind of plant. And so, but the way you get rid of the blackberry, I mean, I remember working with my dad and we would take them out by the roots, but they would grow right back. I mean, you just, there just seemed to be no way to kill it, just kind of like the fungus on your toe. But there is a technique for killing blackberries, which are goats. What you do is you get a goat and you leave the goat by the blackberry bushes. And every time a little leaf pops up on the blackberry, the goat eats it. Yeah. And so what the goat does is, over the course of a few months, literally eats every green leaf off the blackberry bush, and eventually the blackberry vine dies. But if you simply pull it out of the ground, it comes back. I mean, so the only way to do it is actually keep stripping the leaves off. And stripping the leaves off for a week won't work. It'll grow new leaves. But the whole idea is you eventually starve the blackberry, because every time it produces leaves, the goat comes along and chews them off. And so that's one of the reasons why I think God gave us goats. They'll eat anything, and they'll eat it right down to the ground. Matter of fact, that's how we're now taking care of fire breaks here in Southern California. We're not using bulldozers, because the problem with bulldozers, they leave stuff behind and it grows back. But if you use goats, they'll eat every little thing right down to the dirt. They leave nothing. So they'll even eat the garbage that we leave behind. I mean, so they take care of your paper. They take care of any clothing material. I mean, they'll eat everything.
And, huh? What about, like, are blackberries really thorny?
Blackberries are really thorny.
But goats don't care about thorns.
Well, they'll just go in there and eat the leaves. So they'll eat the berries, too. But, you know, once the berries are gone, they go after the leaves. So, but yeah, that's the wonderful thing about goats. They'll actually eat on command. You can train a goat. And that's what they do in these fire breaks here. They train the goats to eat 10 feet of vegetation this way, 10 feet of vegetation that way, and they just eat straight in the line. And, and you know, if you've got a slope that's 70 degrees, no problem. That goat can go up a 70-degree slope. A bulldozer can't, but a goat can. It'll go up a steep slope, and it'll basically eat everything you tell it to eat and leave the stuff you tell it not to eat alone. Goats will do that. Now, my dog won't, but the goats will. They'll eat everything exactly as you command them to eat. And so goats are wonderful. But likewise, we're discovering that bacteria and fungi can be wonderful as well. Yes. Question?
No, I was going to testimony that actually works. We have a Boy Scout camp that's on the border of Orange County and L.A. County, and they have a goat herder there who you know, have a goat trim on property, and they had that big, nasty fire down in Orange County and Irvine, the fire went around our camp because there was just not enough to burn because of ghosts.
Well, goats are good because, I mean, if you use a bulldozer, it simply turns the dirt over and leaves vegetation buried, and that stuff will come back. But a goat will literally eat it right down to the roots. Yes.
I wonder if that would be a way around the environmental protection laws, you know, that say you can't kill or cut down certain kinds of plants that, you know, cause fires, but if you fed them to the goats.
There you go. Yeah. And the back. No, I want to move on. Let's go. Maybe because of bacteria like it, I don't know. Anyway, my trip to Trinidad got shortened. That's why I'm here today. I made a quick trip down there and a quick trip back. I'm not sure I'd ever do that again because, I mean, the jet lag was really brutal going down and back, mainly because I was down there for just 2 days. And so they scheduled me from the time I got off the plane to the time I got back on the plane. So anyway... But what's interesting about going to Trinidad is that the officials at immigration are extremely fastidious. So here we were in this long line, and they were taking 10 minutes per person, asking us all kinds of detailed questions. And so they take their job very seriously. But I mean, hey, we landed at 9:30 at night. Then you're in this long line, and the immigration people are taking 10 minutes per person. And, you know, we had probably 1,000 people in line there. So it really took us a long time to get through the immigration line. And the ladies behind me were really complaining about the wait. And so anyway, we managed to get to talking, and they wanted to know why I was going to Trinidad, because I was the only white face in the entire line. So it did attract some attention. And they were appalled that I wasn't staying for Carnival. I said, and that was the thing. It was a week before Carnival. And it's like, that's why there was such a jam in the airport. And I said, no, I'm leaving before Carnival starts. And they said, well, nobody leaves just the day before Carnival. And I said, well, I do. I really don't want to be around here during Carnival. And what happens during Carnival, the population of Trinidad is 1 million. During Carnival, it goes over 2 million. So, I mean, a place really gets packed out. So so they said, what is it that, you know, wants you to cause? So I told them what I was doing, and they were super excited, and they all wanted to get on our mailing list, managed to give them a couple of our booklets. So and that made their wait in line a little more pleasant. And theirs says, we're so happy you're coming to Trinidad. We really need this message here in Trinidad. So, but the first message I gave was on the origin of soulish animals. It's a little bit of the material I've given here in the class and went through the book of Job, although we've developed it considerably since then. And I was interested in this talk because I was speaking before a group of psychologists. There were, you know, a couple dozen psychology professors there from all over North America. And, you know, I don't normally speak that far out of my discipline, but I was curious as just to how they would respond to this message. And they responded very well, and recognized that in psychology they've ignored the higher animals as a group of study. It says, we've studied the higher animals for their physical features, but we really haven't studied these higher animals for their psychological features. And I was surprised that they weren't aware of any of the papers I was referring to in my talk. And so they were really excited to see that this is something we really needed to discuss. And also we had a number of theologians in the audience. This was at the University of Southern Caribbean. I now have the distinction of speaking at all three USCs on North American campus. University of Southern California, University of South Carolina, and now the University of the Southern Caribbean. But the University of the Southern Caribbean is a Seventh-day Adventist university. And that's because about 25% of the inhabitants of Trinidad or Seventh-day Adventists, but they literally pull from all over North America. But it's predominantly students from the Caribbean. Jamaicans make up about half the student body. So and a lot of the professors have gotten their PhDs there at that university. So I was curious as to how they respond to the theology. And then my second talk was to the theology department on science and Genesis conflict or agreement. And I knew I was kind of walking into a hornet's nest, because this is a subject of intense debate by Seventh-day Adventists. And I also knew that it was going to be disturbing for them to hear my theological perspective, that God creates for six long periods of time, and then there's a long period of time for the Sabbath rest. They were okay with the six long periods of time for God creating. What was a real challenge for them was to think of the seventh day as also being a long period of time. But I had an opportunity just to explain to them how it explains why we can see evidence for aggressive speciation of life before humans show up, and we see virtually none after humans show up. That there really is a discontinuity, and that discontinuity wouldn't exist if the Seventh-day Adventist doctrine were correct, that the seventh day is only 24 hours long. So, and I said, you know, you guys have no problem with the six long periods of time for creation. What's the big deal about a long period of time for God's rest? And then I got into a whole discussion there about how, from a biblical perspective, there's two creations. Well, Seventh-day Adventists have traditionally believed that there's a single creation that God restores to its original pristine condition. But an opportunity just to kind of go through why, from an astrophysical perspective, that would not be possible. The stars cannot last that long. They burn out. And when they burn out, you've got a dark universe with inadequate heat flow to support any kind of life. And they hadn't really thought that part through. But also kind of going through the Bible, making the point that all these passages that Seventh-day Adventists point out to, where it says the stars will burn forever, it says, consider, those are Old Testament passages. The Hebrew word forever also has the equivalent or an alternate literal definition of very long time. And it says it's true. Stars can burn for a very long time, but they cannot burn forever. They're not eternal. Just like the Aaronic priesthood is said to be everlasting. Well, the Aaronic priesthood is not everlasting, but it does last a long time. Whereas in the Greek New Testament, there is a word that means and only means forever or eternal. But in the biblical Hebrew, there is no word that only means forever. There's a word that can mean forever or it can mean a long period of time. So, but what's interesting is by the time we had a long Q&A session with the professors and the students in theology, I was really impressed that by the time we got through it, there was a real sense of peace and resolution. And they let me know, they said, you know, not all Seventh-day Adventists agree in this stuff. And I said, I'm well aware of that. I get invited to speak at a lot of Seventh-day Adventist churches, but are the ones that are typically wanting to grapple with these issues, not just from a theological perspective, but a scientific perspective. So they were quite impressed that we actually get invitations at Seventh-day Adventist churches and get a good reception there. So we finally ended up, there's an agreement between science and Genesis, not a disagreement. And coming home, I ran into a salesman at the Houston airport. I was on Continental Airlines, which has got an improving reputation, but it's still got some ways to go. Namely that they had oversold the flight by about 20 seats, and everybody was getting kind of nervous about whether or not they were going to get bumped. And the guy behind me was saying, yeah, the corporation I work for, I fly all the time. But it says, I never get enough frequent flyer miles to get high priority. I'm always just under about 20 to 23,000 miles. Can't break that 25 or 30,000 mile barrier. And it's because my company always gets the cheapest ticket. And so I keep getting on these different airlines and I just can't. So, well, welcome to the club. I'm in the same position. I always have to fly on the cheapest possible seat, and that's why I always usually sit at the back of the plane, because we paid so little for the ticket. But, you know, we were both worried because, you know, who gets bumped when they have to force people off the plane? Those that paid the least for the tickets. So we were talking to people all around us, and we were saying, oh, no, this is bad news. Nobody has paid as little for the tickets as we have. So, but it started a conversation where he said, you know, well, how come you have to fly so much? So I told him why I flew so much. And he says, oh, that's interesting. I got a son at Durham University in Britain who's getting a PhD in the theology department, but his thesis is on the interface between science and theology. And so then he said, have you ever run into a guy by the name of Hugh Ross? So my son was using his material for his thesis. So I told him I knew Hugh Ross quite well. No, I told him who I was. And actually, I gave him some material that was just hot off our presses at Reasons to Believe. He says, I know my son doesn't have this stuff. So he says, I'm going to read it first and send it on to him. Okay. So that was kind of fun. Well, I found out he comes to L.A. quite frequently. So he says, next time I'm in L.A., I want to stop by your office and talk to your scholars and to see if we can get my son on the phone while I'm there, too, and we can have a meeting that way. So anyway, you never know who you're going to run into. So, well, we're in Psalm 139.
Did you get on the plane?
I got on the plane. He got on the plane, too. So it turned out that a lot of the 20 people that they didn't show. They did have to force some people off the plane, but we did not get forced off the plane. So that was good. Yep. That's right. I'm heading there. Okay. We're going to be in 1 Samuel for the next 2 or 3 Sundays. Because, as I told you, Psalm 139 is written by King David. And it's the psalm that really gets into the origin of humanity and the special status of human beings with respect to all the other animals, and how David continually throughout Psalm 139 makes the point that God has purposely chosen the day of our birth, the day of our death, and everything that happens in between, and that God will intervene supernaturally to rescue us from certain death. Well, what I did while I was flying home from Trinidad, long flights, 10 hours, is actually go through 1 Samuel and count how many times God supernaturally intervened to rescue David from certain death. Well, just between the time he was 15 years of age and the time that King Saul got killed in battle. So this isn't even up to the time where King David had become king, but it's just between the time of being in his mid-teens up to the time probably somewhere in his 20s where Saul and Jonathan were killed in battle, God supernaturally intervened 21 times to save his life. Might have been more, but there are 21 that are recorded in the 1 Samuel. 2 Samuel records a bunch more of where God intervened while he was being groomed to become the king and when he was actually king. But just in 1 Samuel itself, there are 21 instances that are recorded where God supernaturally intervened to rescue him. And the first one we studied last week, which was the lion. Remember, it tells us that here was David, a young teenager, taking care of his father's sheep. And there was an instant where a lion grabbed a lamb and ran off with it. And then David used his sling, struck the lion, stunned it, and then went up to the lion and grabbed the lamb out of the lion's mouth. But the lion was only stunned, and so the lion was, quote, aroused and attacked David. And what David said, he grabbed the lion by its hair and struck it and killed it. And that's not easy to do when you're taking a lamb out of a lion's mouth. But he pulled that off, and he did the same thing with a bear. So you can imagine being face-to-face with a bear and taking a sheep. And typically what happens when a lion or a bear grabs a sheep from the flock, you just say, well, I guess I just chalk up a loss here. You let the lion run away with the sheep and then do your best to protect the rest of the sheep. But that wasn't King David. He went after the lion. He went after the bear, struck it with a sling stone, stunned it, took the sheep out of its mouth. And then when the bear and the lion recovered from being stunned and attacked him, he was able to physically kill the bear and the lion, even though he was face-to-face, literally within inches of those terrifying jaws. And then the third instance we have of King David being rescued from what others would consider certain death, is when he faced Goliath in battle. So this is the best picture I've been able to find of David versus Goliath, where the sizes are about right. And this is all based on the assumption that we go with the short cubit. The text tells us that he was six cubits tall and a bit more than that, and a minimum of 9'9" if you go with a short cubit. If you go with a long cubit, then he's between 12 and 15 feet tall. But 9'9" minimum. And we see David using the same technique. Notice it tells us in the text that David put on Saul's armor and put on Saul's sword, but being just a young boy, he was not able to move around in the armor. So he said, forget the armor, forget the sword, forget the spear. I'll just go after the Goliath with what I'm used to, which is just a light piece of clothing and a sling stone. So, but the tactic was, he took the sling stone and struck Goliath in the one unprotected spot he had, which was his forehead. Didn't kill him, stunned him, but he fell over. And then David ran up and grabbed the sword that Goliath had and cut off his head before he had sufficiently recovered to do David any serious harm. So not something you would expect. And people have said, well, maybe Goliath just was really big, but maybe not that strong, and it wasn't that big of a deal for David. But as it tells us in the text, he carried weaponry and armor into battle, and the armor is listed in 1 Samuel. And if you go with the smallest possible weights you can interpret, he was carrying a minimum of 250 pounds of armor into battle. So when you see this breastplate and the sheaves he has on his legs and what would be around his stomach and the helmet he'd be wearing, I don't think he was wearing a crown like that. He was wearing some kind of a helmet. But at a minimum, all that armor plate came in at 250 pounds. And on top of that, he had a spear and a sword and a shield. So he couldn't have been a weak man. He would have had to be a very strong man. But there's a reason why people have suggested that maybe he wasn't all that strong, and that's because we observe that human beings who are very tall are indeed weak, not strong. And as I mentioned last week, once you get past about 7.5 feet tall, weakness sets in with a real vengeance. And once you get above 8 feet tall, your mobility drops almost to zero. And I told you last week I got to meet in person the man that was called Jaws in the James Bond movies. He's a Christian, but he's about 7 feet eight tall, 7'9" tall. But because of his height, he is now in a wheelchair. He's not able to walk around. But for those James Bond movies, he was young enough in his 20s that he was able to take that role. But I found out from him, by the time he got into his early 30s, his body started to wear down to such a degree that now he's confined to a wheelchair. But the whole point there is that for a human being, the taller you get above a certain height, like 7.5 feet, the lower the mobility you have. And it's something I've written about in the Genesis question, and it's called the physics of basketball. And the physics of basketball is that basketball is a sport gives you the greatest payoff with respect to your height. There's a reason why basketball players are so tall. And it's because if you look at the physics of what it takes to put a basketball into the net, and given the height of the net, it means that your ability to sink a basket goes up with a square of your height, which means a 7 foot tall basketball player should be able to get twice as many baskets for the same level of athletic competence as a 5 foot tall basketball player goes, which probably explains why you don't see 5 footers in the NBA. And the people you do see that are relatively short in the NBA, it's interesting when you watch the NBA games, there's a guy out there 6'1", everybody thinks he's a shrimp. But they're short by the standards of the NBA. But you notice that the shorter players are the ones that kind of play in the backcourt and pass. They're able to run very fast, very mobile, and they can get the ball out to the people who are tall enough where the advantage would be in their favor. But if you look at the really big men in the NBA, you notice they're not very mobile. And it, sometimes you don't get this watching on TV, but I can tell you when you're in the arena, you can see how slowly those big players go down the court compared to the shorter players. The shorter players get down there really fast, and it takes quite a while for Shaquille O'Neal to lumber down underneath the basket where somebody can pass him the ball, and he just drops it in like this. So that's the physics of basketball. And the whole point there is that roughly the best basketball players in the NBA come in at a height of about 6'6", 6'7". If you're lower than that, you have a higher mobility, but your ability to get baskets drops off because you're just too short. But if you're taller than that, then you have such a mobility loss that, again, it's difficult to get as many baskets. And so, for good reason, the Michael Jordans and the Kobe Bryants have been the big scorers because they come right in at that ideal height of about 6'6", 6'7". So shorter than that and taller than that, there's a drop-off in ability, even though the physics of basketball highly rewards people of great height. But because of the mobility loss, and as I mentioned last week, once you get above 8 feet, the mobility loss becomes very debilitating. And the tallest human being that ever lived was 8'11", and that's a human being that had a growth, a growth syndrome, where his body just wouldn't stop growing. Body just continued to grow after he became an adult, and he got taller and taller. But at age 39. He literally died of physical exhaustion and never played basketball. He said, "I was always too tall to play basketball." Can you imagine that, being too tall to play basketball? But he says, "I can't move down the court. I can't move around the court." And but here we have Goliath at a minimum of 9'9", and clearly he's defying the physics of basketball. And I make that point because in order to explain the Nephilim, Goliath was one of the Nephilim. And by the way, here's a trivia question for you. Why did David take 5 smooth stones into his pouch when he only needed one? Goliath had 4 brothers. Goliath had 4 brothers. They were all Nephilim. Now, just to give you an idea of the skill that David had here, you'll read in the book of Judges where it talks about the men of Benjamin and how the men of Benjamin were so good with a sling stone, with a sling that you see here, that they could fire a stone at a hair that was held lengthwise and split the hair. That's how good they were. Well, David must have been of that kind of a quality of a sling thrower. How far away, the text doesn't say. But apparently, and you can read about it in the book of Judges, is that these men of Benjamin were so good with sling stones that the rest of the tribes of Israel were hesitant to go into battle against the smallest of the tribes of Israel because of how good they were with sling stones. So evidently, David had that kind of skill with the sling, because he was able to throw that sling at a very small target and not miss, which you would have to do for the lion, you'd have to do for the bear, and you have to do for Goliath as well. Okay, I've been ignoring a bunch of hands for a good reason. I want to at least get this part out, because we're going to get into a little study just who these Nephilim are. But what I'm telling you by introduction is that the Nephilim cannot be strictly human. And incidentally, of all the Nephilim we see mentioned in the Bible, Goliath is the shortest of the Nephilim for which we have a recorded height. The other Nephilim, evidently, are quite a bit taller. And, for example, the tallest that we see mentioned in Scripture is Og, the king of Bashan. And he was so tall that in order to go to sleep at night, he needed a bed made out of iron that was 13 feet long if you use the short cubit and 6 feet wide if you use the short cubit. So that means he would have probably been at least 12 feet tall and might have been considerably taller. So they can't be strictly human. There must be something about these. And something else you notice about the Nephilim throughout all of Scripture, they were never very numerous. And they existed before the flood. They exist after the flood as well. But the last of the Nephilim disappear with the exit of David's mighty men. In fact, as you go through 1 and 2 Samuel, it's clear that God raised up David's mighty men to get rid of the last of the Nephilim. And one thing you notice throughout the Bible, you first see them in the books of Moses. So they show up for the first time in the book of Exodus, and you see them all the way up through Deuteronomy, and they show up again in 1 Samuel. But by the time you get to 1 Samuel, the Nephilim are now limited to the Philistine plain. And as I mentioned last week, there's only one other source of literature where it speaks about these giant warriors, and that is Greek mythology. And in Greek mythology, there's quite a bit of the material about these super tall, very strong warrior men. And they are last mentioned as moving to the Isle of Crete. And the Isle of Crete is where the Philistines came from. So the Philistines were not native to the land of Canaan. They immigrated from the Isle of Crete into the Philistine plain, the plain of Sharon that we refer to it today in modern-day Israel, and among them were the Nephilim. And so it's possible that the Nephilim were existing not only in Egypt and in Canaan, but also in the Isle of Crete. But they left Greece and went to Philistia, and this is where the Israelites had to deal with them. And we notice, too, that you never see female Nephilim. You only see male Nephilim. And as it tells us in 1 and 2 Samuel, these Nephilim have frequent birth defects. Frequently, they have six toes and six fingers. And so they have birth defects. They're superhumanly tall, and they're male only. So this is all evidence that there must be something non-human, at least to some degree, about the Nephilim. Now, there's four questions that are four hands I saw here. Okay, I'll go to you first, and then to Al. Go ahead.
Well, if you think of non-human flesh, think about a big cat, you know, a big Siberian tiger, a big lion. Those things can jump 30, 40 feet. They're very agile, very powerful. If you were to set them on end, standing on their hind feet, and give them a human body, there's something different about the muscles, obviously, the animal muscles, so... It certainly is credible to me that if
well,
happens,
in terms of the physics here, the challenge is this, is that you're talking a bipedal, large-bodied mammal. So that's the challenge. How do you get someone who's able to use their arms, independent of their legs, be able to fight and battle the way he did? Because, you know, lions and tigers, yeah, they're four-footed and they're heavy. 500-600 pounds. And as I mentioned last week, the bear can get up to 1,500 pounds and still run 30 miles an hour. But it runs 30 miles an hour on four legs. A bear can get up on its two legs, but it's not going to run 30 miles an hour on two legs. What a bear does, it'll rear up on its two legs to look around and get an idea of what's in its territory. But it can't run fast on two legs. Goliath was mobile with two legs. So that's the big difference. Yes?
Yeah, a couple of things. Are the Nephilim mentioned in any other historical books other than the Bible?
And yes, Greek mythology.
And I looked up Nephilim in my computer, and I couldn't find any mention of them at all. I looked up David and Goliath, and it doesn't...
Well, okay. The trick here, Al, is there's many different names for the Nephilim. And so Nephilim is one. The other common reference you see in the Bible to the Nephilim is the Raphaim. The Raphaim and the Nephilim are one and the same. And the other term you see is giants of old. That's also a reference to the Nephilim and the Raphaim.
But is that just in the Bible?
And the Anakites is another name for these super giant creatures. But yeah, if you look in the Greek writings, it refers to these men, again, men only, that are very tall and very successful in battle. That's the one thing you see about both the Greek description of these super tall creatures that's consistent with what you see in the Bible, is that these are the heroes of old. What they mean by heroes is that they are very powerful in battle. So we're not talking some 8-foot-tall human being that can barely move. These are creatures that are famous for their ability to fight in battle. And so that's common to both the Greek writings and the Bible writings. But in both cases, what the Greeks say about it and what the Bible says about it, they are few in number. And so this is not a huge population, a select number. So you've got the Philistines, and probably 99.9% of all the Philistines are ordinary human beings. Sprinkled amongst them are a few individuals, only a few, that are labeled the Raphaim, the Nephilim, the Anakites, the giants of old. And yeah, if you Google all those different terms, I think you'll come up with something. And a hand over here. Yeah.
Hugh, does the, you know, you're talking about this proportionality of the size of a human. It, you know, roughly, it's a proportionality between the gravity of the Earth, right? We're defined. So if we were, if the Earth had less gravity, we would tend to be bigger, possibly, and be able to handle being of a bigger size versus if we had more gravity, we tend to be smaller because we'd have to deal with that all the time.
Well, there's a problem. I wrote about this in my critique of the movie Avatar, the problem with different gravity. And the whole point is the gravity we have here on Earth really is ideal. That if you have less gravity, yeah, potentially you could jump higher and be taller, but with less gravity, you have the problem of falling more easily. So gravity is a stabilizing effect. One reason why we can walk so easily around this planet is because we have a strong force of gravity of putting us down towards the center of the Earth, and that stabilizes our motions. So where you don't have much gravity, your motions become quite unstable. And if you want to see a good example of that, you can go up to, what's that suburb just south of San Francisco? They have a space camp up there. NASA has a space camp at Moffett Field. And for a few bucks, you can go up there, and they will put a garb on you where you get to experience the gravity that the moon has. They also have a Mars simulator where you get to experience the gravity of Mars. Well, the gravity of the moon is 1/6 of ours, and the gravity of Mars is 40% of ours. And indeed, what you discover is you can jump a lot higher at 1/6 gravity or 40% gravity than you can here on Earth. But you quickly figure out it's not a good idea to jump, because you just can't land well and you can't recover well. You don't have that sense of balance. It takes gravity to get that sense of balance. But there's a problem with having too much gravity. If you've got too much gravity, your muscles have to work too hard to take the weight. Matter of fact, what they discovered with the Apollo astronauts that went to the moon, what really helped them to be more stable walking around the moon was to give them really heavy packs. And the heavy packs kind of simulated the Earth's gravity. Well, they needed heavy packs anyway, just to keep their bodies appropriately temperature controlled. They had to carry a 250-pound air conditioner on their back. Well, because it's 1/6 gravity, a 250-pound air conditioner on your back was no big deal. But it also helped stabilize the movement of the astronauts. But hey, if you want to see what it's like, go up to Moffett Field and have them put you in 1/6 gravity. What they do is they kind of put a little harness on you, and then there's a big pulley with some weights on the other side that take a whole lot of your weight off. And then the pulley system is so that you can actually freely move around, and they tell you to walk. Well, you quickly figure out you can't walk. And then they load a bunch of weight on you, and then you can walk with some difficulty. And actually, part of the astronaut training is learning how to walk with weak gravity. So in that sense, yeah, you could be taller, but you're going to have a problem. And that's one thing, too. There's a reason why you don't see too many very tall creatures on the face of the Earth, because when they fall, they're going to hurt themselves because of the force of gravity. And so someone who's 7'6", they have to be wary of falling, because they're going to fall a lot farther when they hit the ground than those of us who are shorter. And so, you know, as you notice with all of your little kids, when they're 3 and 4 years of age, they fall all the time. They hardly ever hurt themselves. That's because they're so close to the ground. When you're 6 feet tall and you fall, you're going to do a little more damage when your head hits the concrete. And so this whole idea that T-Rex was running at 50 miles an hour, like you see in Jurassic Park, can't be. T-Rex is way too tall to be running in that kind of velocity. If that was the case, T-Rex would be killing himself quite quickly just through falls and accidents. Yes?
I understand that elephants are very sure-footed and almost never fall.
They're very sure-footed and they hardly ever fall, but notice the platform they got. They got these four legs with big, huge, and you see that with the dinosaurs too, that the really big dinosaurs have huge legs. In fact, you can go to Utah and see some dinosaur prints. 2 feet in diameter is how big their legs were. So in that sense, it gave them stability. But also, you notice the gait they have is designed to give them stability. So that if one leg stumbles, the other three are able to recover. And also, that little trunk they have plays a big role in being able to stabilize them. So we don't have a trunk. I don't know anybody who's got a nose big enough to give them any kind of stability or a tail. See, that's the thing here. We don't have a tail for Goliath, and we don't have any kind of trunk to help him get that kind of stability.
Maybe he did have a tail.
Maybe he did have a tail. Who knows? We don't know. Maybe you're right. Yes. Well, Genesis 6, verse 3 says that 6:2 and 6:4 say that the Nephilim were upon the earth in the days before the flood, and how the flood wiped out all the Nephilim. Because one thing we also see is consistent with the Nephilim, they're all wicked. There are no righteous Nephilim. Every one of them are incredibly wicked in their moral behavior, without exception. And they're all tall. And they're all able to be very effective in battle, and they're all male, and a lot of them got birth defects. But also it says in Genesis 6:4, there were Nephilim upon the earth in the days before the flood wiped them all out, but they came back. There's Nephilim after the flood as well. And the Nephilim persisted all the way down to the time of King David. But for the last 3,000 years, there have been no Nephilim. Now, you can pick up the appendix of my book, The Genesis Question, that's sitting over there. It's a blue book over there. It actually gives you every single verse in the Bible. It talks about the Nephilim, the Raphaim, the Anakites, the heroes of old, all those terms. So we actually give you all the verses, and you can see for yourself that they're masculine, they're always wicked, and that God seems to be very aggressive about ridding the earth of the Nephilim. Why? Because of their propensity to spread moral wickedness to human beings. The Philistines were in trouble because the Nephilim were amongst them. And so their moral behavior was quite despicable as a result. Yes?
Did Noah and his family have a giant gene in them that they repopulated after the flood?
Well, there's a debate over who the Nephilim are. And there's three positions on how to interpret the Nephilim and how they got here. And I mention all three in the Genesis question and give you the arguments in support of each one and against each one. The most common explanation is what you see in Genesis, namely that God is asking the sons of Seth to separate themselves. And so it's making the point that the sons of Seth had physical intercourse with the daughters of Cain, and that produced a Nephilim. And so they went against God's command, and the offspring were these giants. Now, the evidence against that is, how do you explain their superhuman capabilities? And so the people who have developed that theory have that as a problem, and mainly because they've overlooked the supernatural characteristics. They presumed that if you're 12 feet tall, no big deal. But the problem is, if you're 12 feet tall, there's a huge problem. You run into problems with the laws of physics. So, the other explanation is that demons came down and had intercourse with the daughters of men. That has strong support in the sense that it says the sons of God came and had intercourse with the daughters of men. And the sons of God is a term that can refer to angels, or it can refer to human beings. And consequently, what I've done in the Genesis question is give you every verse in the Bible that talks about sons of men and sons of God, contrasted, or pardon me, sons of God and children of God contrasted with sons of men and the children of men. And also do a word study on son of God and son of man. Because one of the things you notice is that Jesus, while he was here on earth, before he was crucified, always referred to himself as a son of man. But in the epistles, after the crucifixion, resurrection, he never calls himself the son of man. He only refers to himself as a son of God. The other thing you notice in the Gospels is he refers to his followers throughout the Gospels as sons of men and children of men. Whereas in the epistles, he only refers to his followers as sons of God and children of God. There's a difference. And so the question is this, what is the difference? Well, what Paul points out is the difference is the baptism in the Holy Spirit. That after Jesus rose bodily from the dead, the Holy Spirit came and took permanent residence in the hearts of every follower of Jesus Christ. And that's what made them a son of God and made them a child of God. Whereas he never referred to his disciples as sons of God because that hadn't happened yet. And so this is a future event, so he referred to them as sons of men. Likewise, he called himself the son of man for that very reason. He hadn't yet become, quote, the son of God in the context of redemption because he hadn't yet paid the price for all of humanity's offenses against God by dying on the cross. And so up until the time he died on the cross, he only referred to himself as the son of man. And then afterwards, he called himself the son of God, never called himself the son of man. Well, the distinction there is, how can the sons of God in Genesis 6:4 be human beings because the baptism in the Holy Spirit not yet happened? They must therefore be angels. So it's angels that came down and had intercourse with these women. Now, there's a weakness with that argument. The weakness is this. It tells us several times in the Bible that angels cannot marry, that the angels do not marry. And so if the angels do not marry, how can you explain angels coming down and picking these daughters of men, have their wives, and having offspring by them? Now, there's a rebuttal to that. People who claim that they really are demons say, well, it says that they do not marry. It doesn't say that they cannot marry. And then you've got what you see in Jude 6. Jude 6, we have Jude selecting out a certain subclass of the fallen angels, the demons, and refers to this subclass of demons as angels who have left their estate. And because they have left their estate, God has placed them in the abyss. And you notice that when Jesus was casting out demons in the Gospels, when he would cast the demons out, the demons always appealed to Jesus by saying, "Do not send us to the abyss. We don't deserve to go there." Well, what you see in the book of Jude is that this abyss is a prison house for those angels who left their estate. So not all the demons are in the abyss. A minority of the demons are in the abyss. Now, what's interesting is that word left their estate, if you look at the Greek word behind it, it's the same Greek word that's used for bestiality. And so this is support the idea that indeed angels, fallen angels, committed bestiality by having intercourse with a different species, namely the daughters of men. There's a third position. The third position comes in and says there are strengths and weaknesses with the other two positions. And so they try to come up with a position that they claim has no weaknesses, which is that it's not demons, it's not men, it's demon-possessed men that had intercourse with these women. But if they're demon-possessed men, then how do you explain these superhuman features? Because all of the research has been done on demon-possessed people is that, yes, the angel will come in and take control of the body. Basically, what's happening with demon possession is that, you know, every one of us, we have a body. But the body is not the real you. The real you is the spirit that controls your body. But with demon possession, a demon will come into your body and wrestle control of your body away from you. And so with a demon-possessed human being, it's like you're dealing with two different persons. Well, for good reason. There's two different persons actually in there. Now, I say this, this is different from what you call multiple personality disorder. I'm out of time. Okay, and there's a congregational meeting. I'm going to stop right now. We'll pick up our discussion in the Phelan. Hopefully I got your curiosity aroused, right? And get you thinking about this. But you know, if you don't want to wait till next week, you can get the scripture list. If you don't want to buy the book, just take a note card over there, write down all the scriptures, and then look them up for yourself and figure it out all on your own. Father in heaven, we thank you that your word has not left us without the resources to answer these kinds of questions. And Father, I pray that you would deliver us from any fear that they've been feeling have come back. And we thank you, Lord, that you've given us the assurance that indeed you have taken care of this problem. And that we're grateful for that. And that we're also grateful that we live in a day and an age when we're no longer simply just sons of men, but we have the capability of being transformed into sons of God. And so, Father, I pray that you would help us to live our life as sons of God. And Lord, those of us who have not yet received you as Lord and Savior, I pray that we would look upon what you've offered, that wonderful trade, to trade our moral imperfection for your moral perfection. And Lord, I pray that as we become sons of God, we would live the life as if we really are sons of God, who we are. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, congregational meeting, so let's hustle out there, and let me pack up here. Thank you.